The Business on RTE Radio 1 with AIB. Whatever stage your business is at, there's always time to imagine sustainable, positive change. AIB, for the life you're after.
Now, let's have a listen to this. Well, isn't that a comforting thought to lift our spirits on this rainy and chilly Saturday morning? The band, of course, is D-Ream, fronted by Peter Cunna, one of Derry's most enduring musical talents. And while it's not every day that a hometown musician is celebrated with a mural, in the coming days, the final brushstrokes will complete a new public artwork in his honour on the street where Peter grew up. So while the mural was still coming to life, I went along to meet the man of the moment. Well, I'm here at Fawn, outside Buncrana in County Donegal, overlooking Loch Swilly, and I'm here to meet Peter Cunna. And I'm just at the house now.
Richard.
Hello, Peter. How are you?
Come on in. Come on in. How the hell are you?
Very nice to meet you. And this is a beautiful spot.
Oh, we're very blessed. It's a pinch-me place to live.
Peter, we're right up against Loch Swilly here. Fabulous view.
Yeah, that's what sold the house to us. The view from our house is... That's Inch Island. As a nipper, I used to hold up my thumb to see if it was actually an inch. So we're very blessed, to be honest here, Richard.
Well, we're here in your studio and it looks fantastic. There's vinyl records, cassettes, mixing desk and various guitars and instruments. What's this one here beside us? It's an old looking guitar.
It is an old guitar. It's an old jazz guitar with F holes, as you can see. It looks like a violin body guitar. But this is my first guitar, and it's the one I wrote Things Are Going to Get Better on, and You're the Best Thing. And I was actually at a big gig down at the Royal Albert Hall, and the headliners were Elton John and Sting. And I just, you know, I just took it down with me thinking, I'll give this a second lease of life. And I got them to sign it. And God, it took some persuading to get the security to let me through to them, and we were in the sort of the low life area, and they were all in
the support
exactly, and but I got them to put their names on it, and then later on I got Midger on there, I got Graham Goldman from 10cc, and I'm just now waiting on Van Morrison to come forward and Nile Rodgers, and then we'll be there, and I'm going to auction that for the Derry Hospice, who looked after my cousin and my brother in their time of need. So that's the plan.
Wow, that's a fabulous thing to do with it. Would you be sorry to see it go?
I will. But the thing is, if it raises a bit of money for a good cause, it can't be a bad thing.
You grew up in Derry City?
I did. I was born in Belfast. I was adopted in Derry City by my mum, Monica, and my father, Les, in 1966.
Was that something that you found out about at an early age?
I was very lucky. Mum used to sit there and play me, you know that song, Nobody's Child? It was one of her regular favourites, and she'd had a wee G&T, and she'd sit there and the tears would be dripping down her cheek. And she turned around one night and says, "Now, you know, son, you're not my real son that your mammy and daddy gave you to me."
What age were you?
I couldn't have been more than 4 or 5, maybe, coming up for 5. And I sort of thought about it for a nanosecond. I was like, "But mammy, you're going to be my mummy and daddy." I think what she was trying to do was stop me from being bullied, because a lot of kids would cotton on that I didn't look like my brother and sister. So when I got into the playground at St. Patrick's Pennyburn, a couple of people come up to me and says, "I'm not going to repeat it on radio, but kind of you're a B-starred, okay?" And I went, "Yeah, and what?" So they'd nowhere to go. They couldn't bait me on that because I knew. And then so they knew and they accepted it. It's funny, isn't it, the dynamics of children and the cruelty. You know, the cruelty was back then.
Your own reaction to it as a kid, as children were more concerned about the future than about the past. So you're kind of thinking, you know, are you still going to be my mommy and daddy?
That was it. But the fact is, they were very loving. Dad was an ex-Navy boy from the Royal Navy. And Mum was just a simple factory girl. And she'd done well. She was just so loving. And I got a really good environment to grow up in. Most of my greatest wishes were granted. If it was an airbrush, I got an airbrush. If it was my first electric guitar, I got that. So they really, really encouraged me, even though they couldn't hold a note between the pair of them.
And were you really into music at an early age? What are your first recollections of what you were listening to?
My dad had one of those, you know, the gramophones, the units, that they're treasured pieces now. So it was like a sort of G-Plan style furniture thing. It had the built-in speakers. And it had 78 on the turntable. 78, 33 and 45. So I remember getting the stool and climbing up to this thing and pushing up the sort of pneumatic lid. And inside I would pick up my favourite record, which was a live version of Go Granny Go, what they call Little Ole from Pasadena by the Beach Boys. And I put that on like until I nearly wore it out. So I'm surprised I never became a DJ because that was one of my first things, you know.
But you did get together with friends and form bands.
Without even knowing. I mean, one of the first things I do remember was I used to pick up the candlestick and put it up near the hearth and stand there with my little toy guitar and pretend to be Elvis. And later on, I tried to form a band at school. We couldn't have been more than 9 or 10, but I'd already learnt the riff to Message in a Bottle.
And your mum and dad were very encouraging of that. They got you your first electric guitar.
That's right. One Christmas, I remember we were told we'd get one big present in our lives, you know. I think my sister's was a bike, but I got this. I woke up to Christmas morning. I think I must have been about 11 or 12, actually. And he bought me a Fender Mustang, which they call, it's Kurt Cobain guitar. They call it a student guitar.
So what was your first band then?
The first real band was called, we weren't called Tithe the Boy to start with, but there was some, I met Kevin Williams through a mutual friend and we went about the business of just looking at his songs and we sort of, by the time I think I was 15 and he was 17, but we had our first gig within a year and then we got Jerry Diver, the mayor of Derry, Jerry Diver, who went on bass, and then Tim Hegarty, you know the Hegarty family, they did all the property stuff. So it was great because they had the Butchers as well and that meant that we had a van. But the problem was the vans, even though they cleaned them, still smelled of, butchery.
Freezing probably as well.
Freezing, but also you turn up to the gig and if a girl took a few steps back, you knew why.
Blame the van.
Yeah, I blame the van. Yeah, exactly.
And that band lasted for a good while. And you're actually much more recently back doing things with them.
It's really bizarre. Well, my dad passed away in about 2024 there. And we were at his funeral and the lads turned up, you know. And I was sitting there, we were sharing a few Guinness. And we were just sort of like, it's about three Guinness in now before we were like the Blues Brothers. We're going to get the band back together. You know how you get all that. And the next thing I know, they've offered us a charity gig up at the Nerve Centre. So on the 1st of April, I think, 2024, we were standing on a stage together with Bam Bam and the Calling, just playing to all our friends again. And it was just a fabulous night. We raised about $5,500 for a mental health charity. It was great.
And going back to your adoption, do you remember when you met your biological mother for the first time?
I do. It was incredible. I think Pope John Paul changed the law. They said they didn't have the records. And in the 90s, there was like a truth thing going through the church. And they opened up all the records. And there was the Catholic Care Society was formed. And they allowed these women to come forward and reconnect with their children. And so I got a letter through the post. And I was in London and D-Rean was just about forming. Things were taking off for me. And I was on the phone to my mum. I rang her all the time. And she said, son, there's a letter here for you. I've been waiting for this letter addressed to you all your life. This letter, I still have it. It's a whole outpouring of emotions from my natural mother, Anne.
And I'm sure you'll never forget the first time you actually met her.
No, but from that letter, we made the arrangements to go and meet. And my mum and dad literally run me up the road to Strabane to meet them. And we all walked through together. And I remember the day she opened her door, she says, my door will always be open to you, son. And I said, that's great, mum. Get the kettle on. But fast forward now to this year. Because my dad died, I started poking around. I got given some leads by a sister-in-law. And she got me in touch with this fella, Pat Dusky. Now, Pat Dusky, it turns out, is my father. His real name's Pat Hannah. Dusky was the stage name. And I made contact. Now, it turns out that that side, they're all musicians. And they all make a living out of it. So by his first wife, he had two kids, Jackie and Stuart. Stuart Zander is the bass player with Jamiroquai. He co-wrote and produced the first three Jamiroquai albums. And I'm finding out this is like different level stuff. And then Jackie's a bass player as well. And fast forward to Philippa Hanna. She's massive on the Pentecostal scene. You know, she calls Jesus her homeboy. And she plays to like 100,000 people. She's playing South Africa at the end of this month, you know, to 100,000 people.
And you've connected with all of these extended families.
It's incredible. Richard, I feel privileged because not only did I get a great outcome with Monica and Les, but I got to meet my natural mother and then my natural father. Now, circumstances for them, they were actually in the same band together. That's how they had me. But when Anne fell pregnant, it, obviously in those years, there was a lot of stigma around single parent mothers. I think a lot of her communications to Patrick were cut off by the family. So he never knew. He heard rumours, but he never knew. But the thing is, for me to be sitting, they came down to my show. We did a show in, I think it was in the Midlands there, at a stately home, a castle. And Happy Mondays were headlining. And they all showed up and they all had T-shirts on. And on the T-shirts, it was, things going to get better, right? And of course, I was going, that's a bit cheesy. Underneath it said, now you found us. And on the back, it had their job. So it was like dad, stepmom, stepsister, sister, husband. And it was like brilliant. And I thought,
the ultimate groupies.
The ultimate. I mean, I've got a great photograph of us all doing that. And do you know what? It's turned out good for me. And the one thing I wanted to say, I've seen a lot of negative stuff about the mother and baby homes. And I think for most people, that's been the case. It's just that mine's been an incredible outcome. And I think it's nice to share something positive in a world where there's so much that's not.
And going back to the music and forming then D-Ream and the success, you went to England and the band became really successful.
Well, the thing about Tyler Boys, we were signing to Mother Records, U2's homegrown. If you think of Applecore by the Beatles, it was a similar idea that they had. Now, they gave us all the Lift Up, Tuesday Blue, the Hot House Flowers, Tyler Boy. We ended up in London, but it didn't work out. And I found myself, I had the option to go home with my tail between my legs or stay the course. And I did. I stayed on friends' floors. I sofa surfed. And the next thing I knew, I was in the right place at the right time. I could make music. I could produce and arrange. I could sing. I could write. And the house music scene was just taking off. So when I got together with Al McKenzie, he came over to my house and he sat down. And the first thing he said, make that kick drum last for 32 bars. And I said, who in their right mind is going to listen to this? It's just really boring. He says, it's not for you. It's for other DJs so they can lock on from the previous record. And that gets them locked in. They call it locked in. And I was like, blimey, that's what I call like studio knowledge. That's gold. So the next thing, the first record we worked on was a song called You're the Best Thing. And when we got that out into the clubs, I was going down on my push bike with 10 copies. And it was about 20 minutes from where I lived in Notting Hill Gate. And the next week I went back, he says, I want 20. And I couldn't do it for each shop. So I had to get a van and go down and serve. And we sold 20,000. It was the first pressing. This was a scene that was just doing its own thing. They weren't on radio. You couldn't hear these records on the radio. It was before the scene crossed over.
The success then that you had, and particularly with Things Can Only Get Better. Yeah. What was life like for you during that?
Mental, hectic. I used to answer the phone going, London Madhouse, can I help you? I knew if we got the music right for the scene, then the rest of it would do its own word of mouth. So it was great. And it was wonderful.
Was it very rock and roll, very glamorous?
I suppose the code for rock and roll, yes, yeah, and the rest. And look, as a young man, I indulged. But I paid for that, got myself clean, then got married, settled down, had kids. But, you know, the legacy of Things Can Only Get Better just lives on and on. It will not go away.
The song was famously adopted by Tony Blair and New Labour. Yeah. How did that come about and what was that like?
Well, at the end of 96, I got myself together and I got a new manager, a fellow called Jazz Summers. He's a bit of a legend in the music industry. But he got on the phone and he's like, Pete, you know, Labour want to use it. And I can't tell you how persuasive a man is who spends his time persuading people. So he wore me down and he said, you've got to come down to the Houses of Parliament, see what it is they have to say. So we got down there and John Prescott literally walked us around the Houses of Parliament and schmoozed us. And I don't know if you've ever been schmoozed, but it was all of that.
This is the famous John Prescott. Two Jags, John.
Don't throw an egg at me or you're going to get it right in the kisser, you know. Nobody, some guy, like, and he was going, we love that band, Dirt Ream, and we'd really like you to get on board and all this. Like, all right, okay. And so it was like, it was kind of, I was kind of like, okay, I can see the sea change. Let's get him in and behind us. And then by 97, they were rolling it out as the kind of campaign tune, which was just very strange because they'd got rid of the red flag thing, which made them very socialist and communist, and they'd been rebranded as New Labour. So we were there in Festival Hall when they got a majority on the night. And I was just skipping down the stairs the next morning, like Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers just going to our car. And it was like, this is a new dawn. And what I did, what every self-respecting musician would do. And I went up to IKEA to buy a sofa. So that was a great chapter in our life. But listen, it's a great thing for us. We're still busy because of it. People go nuts when they see us live and they just let go. And it's got that spirit in it of just release and joy. So I can't knock it, not at all.
Musicians often have a strange relationship with their most famous song. It can be a bit love-hate at times.
Oh, love-hate a long time ago, but now, you know, I'm much more mature now. I'm facing 60 next August, and I've made my peace with it, and I really enjoy it when we do it live because you get so many people coming up, and it's almost like it's as new as the day it was born.
Reflecting back then on that whole musical career and that time that you had, and then how things got really difficult for you in relation to drugs and getting through it. Was it easy to go through that process, that rehabilitation? And what about afterwards?
None of that's easy. You're just basically, look, the thing about drugs is they, especially drugs I was taking, cocaine and alcohol and ecstasy, they're all like a substitute for any feelings that you have. And what you do is you end up taking them to try and feel like just normal. And that's the problem, because you can never take enough to feel normal. So you get to a point where it's just ruining your health. And if you don't draw a line under it or get help, you're going to just go in, you're going to kill yourself. So there's nothing easy about it. I spent 4.5 years basically in what we call the rooms, just like, you know, going through the process of the 12-step program. And it was great because I got out of that. The back of the labor thing was good. I was sober as a judge for all of that stuff. And then by the time I got married and we had our first children, I was good. You know, I was really present and clear and in the moment, you know. And these days, I don't worry about it so much, but because I'm not under that kind of pressure, I believe, from back in the day. So you move on, your songs move on, your band move on. But I'm great now. We're doing a lot of gigs next year. We did Glastonbury last year. I've got a great live show with my band, and we really enjoy each other's company.
What was it like coming back to Ireland after a few decades living in London?
Three decades I was in London. You know, got over there in the late 80s with Ty the Boy, 88, 89. And then I came back in 2019. So yeah, you're talking 3 decades. I always had my eye on a place back home. And I wanted to come home because my mum and dad weren't well. My sisters had been taking care of them, and it was time for me to roll my sleeves up. So I sort of got back, bought this place, this lovely place in Fawn, Elsinore House. And it's been amazing because I had my last 6 months with my mum and then my last 4 years with my dad, and I got to know them so well, and I looked after them, and I felt I'd done the right thing.
And you're only a few minutes drive out the road from Derry City, where you grew up. How important is that to have that home place on your doorstep? Because they're putting up a mural on the street, Clarendon Street, where you grew up.
Oh, that's a funny story. That's nuts, because Eileen, who's behind that, bought number 46 where I grew up. And there was a skip outside and some scaffolding. And one day I popped in just to show me head to see. And I was looking around at it. They were doing it right. You know, they took it back to its bare bones, and they've transformed that house in a way that my mum and dad could never have afforded to. They didn't have the skills and they didn't have the money. But she's done a great job. And it's actually an Airbnb now. You can go and stay in my old bedroom at the top floor. And so she came up with the idea of this because McGonagall's, the solicitors, were going to paint their gable ends. She said, why don't you let me decorate it for you? I've got this mural. And so she presented them with this. They thought, that's a great idea. But unlike most murals in Derry, she decided to ask for permission and not forgiveness, which meant she went through the planning process for about a year before, because it's a listed area. And finally, Derry City Council gave her all the permissions she needed, and then the local businesses did the same. So there's now scaffolding up, and the guy, I think his name's Carl, who painted the Derry Girls mural, he's doing this one.
It's a form of recognition of what you have done. What about the music industry today, Peter, and AI and the impact of AI?
Well, it's gone. It's completely gone. They're just signing AI artists, and that's telling you what's happening. There's no humans involved in that. How frustrated are we when we call up a company and you're answered by AI and not a human being? I think there's got to be a backlash against this, because ultimately this isn't artistry at all. There's nothing human in the creation of it. And they've been training these models on all our work anyway. I get 0.0004 cents per stream. I get 1,000 streams. They give me 4 cents. The whole thing's a con. And it has been for years. And what it's doing to us, I don't know where we're at. Now, we hear these things and the novelty's there, but they're signing AI artists to million-pound deals.
But the percentage of AI-generated songs going up on the streaming platforms is quite high. but they only form a tiny, tiny percentage of the download. So the ultimate test will be whether people listen to it or not.
Of course. But if people don't know it's AI, they may stream on it for a while before they find out. I think it should have it carry a message with it and also tell people that it's not going back to an artist. Where is this money going? You know, it's going to corporations. I think we're going down a really, really dark road here for musicians.
What kind of music do you listen to now?
I'm listening to really old stuff. So I've found Odyssey and Heatwave. And so I'm really listening to a lot of these old disco records and really enjoying them because the writing, I mean, Rod Temple's writing. And I still love my Prefab Sprout and my Blue Nile and all that kind of thing. So that's the kind of stuff I still listen to. But yeah, someone played me Zach Bryan recently and I thought, actually, you know what? I'll have a look at that. And also I'm listening to a girl called C-Matt. He's got a great record of Where Are You Kids Tonight? And I Take a Sexy Picture. She's brilliant. She's got it. She just had, I think she's from Dublin.
Outside Dublin, County Meath, on the Meath Dublin border.
She's had her own mural. She's beat me to it.
Peter Cunha, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much for joining us on the programme.